You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole translators of Steiner into English and give me permission to record these lectures. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 181 by Rudolf Steiner, a number of cycles put together, entitled Dying Earth and Living Cosmos, translated by Matthew Barton. And we are beginning with the cycle Dying Earth and Living Cosmos, which is Lecture 1, given in Berlin on the 22nd of January, 1918. My dear friends, I scarcely need tell you what a pleasure it is for me to be with you again at this difficult and testing time. It has been a long while since we had the opportunity to discuss spiritual scientific themes, and in these grave times it will be especially apparent that far removed from mere theory, a science of the spirit must instead be a real and firm foundation that unites human souls. Not only here on the physical plane, it should unite us too with souls at present living in worlds of spirit. This is a special concern for us at this time, since numberless souls have left the physical plane under circumstances we have so often spoken of. So many souls in the world are still exposed to trials perhaps graver than any so far seen in history. Quite apart from the general thoughts alive in us, as we embark again on these lectures here and elsewhere, I would like to try to specifically formulate words in which our feelings can turn both to those in the thick of combat and to those, too, who have already crossed death's threshold as a result of these events. Quote, spirits, guardians of earthly souls, who live and weave within these earthly souls, safeguarding and protecting them with love, flowing from universal wisdom. O, hear our plea, perceive our love, that wishes to unite with your radiant helping powers, that desires to send our spirit-surrendered love. Close quote. And toward those who have already crossed the threshold of death, we send these thoughts. Quote, spirits, guardians of sphere-born souls, who work and weave upon these sphere-born souls, safeguarding and protecting them with love, flowing from universal wisdom. O, hear our plea, perceive our love, that wishes to unite with your radiant helping powers, that desires to shine forth our spirit-intuiting love. Close quote. For many years now, through the knowledge of spirit to which we aspire, we have sought to approach closer to the being who resolved to pass through the mystery of Golgotha for Earth's healing and for the freedom and progress of humanity. May this being be with you now in your difficult undertakings. It may be that these grave and testing times will increasingly reveal to human souls how important it is to deepen their spiritual focus. If so, this difficult era will not have been in vain for humanity's present and future life. And yet one gets a sense, and I am not saying this as any kind of criticism of anyone, but rather as an appeal to the right and proper feelings, that people have not yet sufficiently learned the lessons of current events. One gets a sense of the need to speak ever more clearly and directly out of the spirit of our times to human hearts and souls. You see, voices other than human voices can also speak to us, can resonate mysteriously from present realities that are grievous on the one hand, but also profoundly significant. Everything I can say today, in stumbling and inadequate words, is vivid before me especially because in my recent trip to Switzerland, I witnessed many things that showed me how our spiritual movement relates to the needs of our time. If you have read the lecture cycle I gave in Vienna before the war, about human experiences between death and rebirth, and everything this involves in relation to human life in general, if you have read this carefully, you will know that at the time I pointed to the deeper causes and foundations of events which later came to such dire expression. Reading between the lines of present experiences, of what is now happening, we can find living proof of the truth of what was said then, before the war. At the time I characterized the general ailment of our age in radical terms. Here and there one sees that some lessons have been learned from these tumultuous events, but there are unmistakable signs too, especially apparent if one correlates separate and seemingly unimportant things, that human thinking on the physical plane has become very inflexible over the past few hundred years, and that human beings are very slow to take the decisions and adopt the measures they need to. To start with today, I would like to speak about some of the things I experienced in Switzerland. It seems to me necessary for those who are interested in our movement to have a fuller picture of the whole context of its work, but I will only give a few aphoristic details. It struck me as especially pleasing while I was in Switzerland that there were some young academics at Zurich University who wished me to give a series of lectures relating anthroposophy to various academic disciplines. In response, I gave 4 lectures in Zurich relating anthroposophic spiritual science to, respectively, psychology, history, science, and sociology, the latter dealing with major social and legislative issues of modern society. I think I am right in saying that there was a certain interest, though naturally it fell far short of what one might wish for, in this relating of anthroposophy to academic disciplines. I showed in these lectures how such disciplines need to be complemented, or one could say made complete, by what can only come from anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, and that they remain only partial disciplines, only half or even just a quarter of what they could be if they are not complemented in this way. Wherever I was able to give lectures in Switzerland, I made sure that I illustrated what was lacking today in this regard, and what we need to do to incorporate developments that can lead society in the right direction. One gets the sense that an initial strangely powerful resistance to our efforts in Switzerland has not grown less recently, but rather intensified, though alongside this resistance, a livelier interest has developed too. Since karma led to the building of the Goetheanum in that country, it may be that our work there might have great importance, especially if it is undertaken in the way I sought to shape it, by testifying at the same time to sources of spiritual scientific inquiry that are concealed within German cultural life especially, but regrettably untapped and disregarded. This sense can fill us with a certain melancholy. There is something tragic about it, but on the other hand also something very satisfying. You see, if we realize this significant and dire fact, that German culture is today condemned as some kind of heresy by 4/5 of the world, we can feel melancholy on the one hand, but also very hopeful that an anthroposophically oriented science of the spirit might offer a public voice to German spiritual and cultural life, might be able to give it the voice it has to find if injury is not to be done to the evolution of our earth. If we really speak to people about the spirit, if we speak of the true sources of spiritual life, we will invariably find a way to speak to all human beings, irrespective of national differences. It could also make us melancholy to see that while our efforts in spiritual science have gained some ground, It is clear still that a country like Switzerland finds it increasingly difficult to hold its own against fierce encroachments. It is not easy to preserve any kind of independent judgment against pressure from four-fifths of the world. And it is hard in such a country, which may be neutral, but in which four-fifths of the world still play a part, to say everything that needs to be said. Circumstances in the world have been greatly exacerbated. But in Switzerland, we have the advantage that mere words, mere teachings, are underpinned by the forms and creative elaboration of our Dornach building, which visibly reveals the aims of our spiritual science, and thus can show that this spiritual science, wherever it is permitted to engage in practical life without brutal dismissal, is capable of meeting and mastering the great challenges modern life poses for people today. In speaking of the relationship between anthroposophically oriented spiritual science and other disciplines, and intentions at large in the world today, we need to introduce very new and unaccustomed ideas to people. In their unconscious depths, people have a dim and obscure knowledge that something new must come from somewhere. But their thinking is incredibly inflexible and incredibly slow to absorb new things. A fundamental trait of our modern, fast-moving times is that people think so terribly slowly, as we can see in all kinds of small ways. In Zurich, as I said, it was possible to connect aspects of anthroposophic spiritual science with academic disciplines. I spoke in public in Basel before I gave the lectures in Zurich. A little while before I was due to leave Switzerland, I also received a request from Basel, from entirely academic circles, to speak about the relationship between anthroposophic spiritual science and other disciplines. But it was, of course, too late by then and could not be done. I mention this for two reasons. Firstly, because it would have been very important to speak about our science of the spirit in a hall dedicated solely to academic pursuits and organized by students in Basel. And secondly, because it shows how slow people were to take the initiative, arriving, really, as the doors were closing. It is characteristic that people resolve on something belatedly, which greater mobility of thinking, a greater capacity to assimilate things, could otherwise lead them to undertake sooner. We ought to discuss such things amongst ourselves, so that we know what we are dealing with. If we consider only one of these themes I have been speaking about recently, we can see that significant developments are needed. In Zurich, I spoke, among other things, of the relationship we can discern between anthroposophic spiritual science and the history of humanity. Today, history is taught to children, and then as a subject at university. But what kind of history is this? It has no intimation, even, of the powers at work in humanity's history. And this is simply because the whole of modern intellectual life appeals to and activates human reason, sets in motion ordinary, supposedly fully conscious ideas and concepts, and then uses these to grasp everything. Well, it's true, we can grasp the sense-perceptible natural world in this way, and the kind of thinking that has chalked up such great achievements in the field of mainstream science. But the moment people tried to apply this same thinking to history, they were endeavoring to make history into science. In the 19th century, efforts were made to observe the course of history in the same way as sense-perceptible phenomena. But this can't be done, simply because historical realities have a quite different relationship with life from phenomena studied in science. What are we observing when we study history? What impulses are at work there? We cannot discern the impulses at work in history by using the kind of rational inquiry that can be applied, perfectly well, in mainstream science. The impulses at work in history act in human evolution in the same way as dreams in our dream life. These impulses do not infiltrate the ordinary awareness with which we encounter and master daily life or phenomena studied in science. We could say that historical development is humanity's great dream. The fleeting pictures that play into dreams, though, become clearly delineated in the faculty of imagination which spiritual science develops. For this reason, there is no history that is not at the same time a science of the spirit. And history, in the way it is taught nowadays, is not history at all. Hermann Grimm noted that the historian Gibbon, when describing the first Christian eras, only gave an account of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, and not the gradual rise of Christianity, its growth and flourishing. Grimm, of course, was unaware why a good historian can describe decline extremely well, but is nonplussed by growth and development. It is because history, as understood today, can only grasp what goes under, and not what grows and thrives, which enters human evolution in the same way that dreams enter our individual lives. For this reason, history can only be described by someone who can form imaginations. Without these, historians, say Ranke or Lamprecht, describe only history's corpse, and not the reality at work in historical development. And this is because the impulses at work in history are only dreamed by our consciousness. When ordinary consciousness tries to grasp historical currents, it can only do so from a vantage point in the subconscious. The modern era also offers interesting illustrations of this. If you trace modern developments, you will find that in recent decades people's interest in larger philosophical questions has faded almost entirely, or, much the same thing, has been stultified by academic theory, has become a kind of small-minded doctrinal disputation. It is not for nothing that a schoolmaster currently heads the world's greatest republic and feels entitled to speak on behalf of the rest of the world. If we ask where, in recent decades, one could discern a sense of broader philosophical scope in issues relating to humanity, an almost religious dimension, if you like, albeit of a brutal kind, whereas everything else was more or less in thrall to the dead hand of academic dispute, then it has to be said that this was in socialism. There were real ideas here, though ones which never focused on a life of spirit, but only on brutish material realities. Unfortunately, no other world of ideas surfaced to counter this one. If we perceive these socialist ideas that rose to the surface of life, we find that they are, in a sense, historical ideas, are humanity's dreams. But what kind of dreams? You have to develop a sense for this dream nature of the events in humanity's history. In my lectures in Switzerland, I try to demonstrate this by saying the following. Try appointing people who are very clever, but have no understanding at all of what I call dream impulses, to leading positions of responsibility in society. And then it will soon become apparent how quickly it is possible to systematically destroy a state or society. All you have to do is establish a parliament to hold sway over this state or society, and fill it with nothing but scholars and professors. And this will be a sure means of destroying society. You don't have to appoint professors to these leading positions, since socialist leaders will do it equally well, and the socialist movement has enough professors of its own. One just has to have a sense for such things, and then ask how this whole edifice of socialist theory arose. If attempts were made to introduce these socialist theories in reality, and sad evidence of this may soon be apparent in the East, they could have nothing but a destructive effect. So how did it come about that these socialist ideas took root in human heads, and what is the real nature of these theories? To answer this, we have to have an intimate knowledge of the history of the past 400 years, and especially of the 18th and 19th centuries. We have to know that this history is quite different from the way it is portrayed in history books, and that it is really a picture of conflict between social classes. All Karl Marx did, in essence, was to establish a theory of what humanity had been dreaming over the past 400 or 200 years, what actually existed but has now been dreamt to its end and must make room instead for a new era. The socialism he propounded in his theories at the moment when the reality they related to was past shows that human reason draws on what has already gone under, already become corpse. When it employs modes of inquiry that, for instance, are perfectly valid in science. Such inquiry and knowledge shows us that the world now stands, in fact, at a point of transition, and that people must learn to think differently when they consider humanity's historical developments, which include the present and future, too, that likewise become historical since we approach them through historical development. People will have to recognize that historical development can only be understood through a science of the spirit. We cannot even form a proper picture of very recent events if we don't employ spiritual science. Let me give you an example which I have often cited recently. An important event which occurred between the lines of history, as it were, in Europe in the Middle Ages. We can say these things amongst ourselves, though outsiders would ridicule such an idea. Was European humanity's loss of knowledge about the western parts of the world. Connections had always existed, especially between Ireland, England, and the region we now know as America. Ireland and England cultivated these connections, and only at the time America was said to have been discovered was a papal decree issued forbidding any such contacts with America. Naturally, it was not called America back then. This connection with America really only failed at the time the Spaniards, in quotes, discovered it. But external historical accounts are so unclear that nowadays people have the sense that in Europe no one knew about America before 1492. Almost everyone believes this. And other similar facts can be discovered through spiritual scientific sources. Today we stand at a moment of transition when history must be considered from the spiritual scientific standpoint. But now, people might ask, since spiritual science, as we see it, can only emerge in our present era, how things were in former times. If we look back to earlier times, we find something different, which does, though, relate to what we call imagination in spiritual science. We find myths and legends, and from the power of these myths and legends, these great pictures, impulses, even political ones, were drawn, and were in fact a good deal more real, more in tune with reality, than modern abstract teachings about history or socioeconomics. You see, what makes human society cohere and determines communal life does not have to be formulated or grasped in abstract concepts. It used to be expressed in mythological form. Today we cannot simply start creating myths again, but have to develop imaginations and use these to grasp history, and from this understanding, in turn, form political impulses that will be utterly different from the phantasms so many people dream up today, or that arise, as I would say, from their abstract and school-teacherly impulses. It is not easy nowadays to tell people that historical developments are something that really unfold in the human subconscious rather than in ordinary, alert thinking. And yet, this life of history, hidden from human beings, has a great impact on actual events and on human impulses altogether. One can say, and this became apparent in my lectures in Zurich, that people everywhere wish to embrace knowledge that seeks the spirit, but they do so with inadequate means. In Zurich, one encounters the discipline of academic psychology, so-called psychoanalysis. And following my lectures, some strange exchanges occurred on the subject of the relationship between anthroposophically oriented spiritual science and psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysts approach this world of spiritual science with their eyes blindfolded, in spiritual terms, and are unable to get anywhere with it. Yet this same world is knocking at the door which people nowadays need to open. Professor Jung in Zurich has recently written another pamphlet about psychoanalysis, one of many he has written, and touches there on various issues. But he does so in a way that shows he has inadequate means to embark on all this. One fact I will mention will show you straight away what I mean. Jung cites an example that many other psychoanalysts refer to also. The following happens to a woman who is invited to supper one evening at somebody's house. After supper, her hostess is due to depart from a spa town for a health cure. The guests eat supper together, and then the lady of the house departs, as do the others. The woman in question accompanies one group of guests. As sometimes happens after a party, they are walking along in the middle of the road instead of on the pavement, when a cab comes driving around the corner. All the guests step back on the pavement to get out of its way, but not the lady we're speaking of. She ran along in the middle of the road in front of the horses while the coachman shouted to her to step away. She kept on running, nevertheless, until she reached a bridge over a river where she decided to throw herself over the edge to escape her predicament. She did so and was saved by the other guests who had run along behind. And since the most obvious thing at this point was to carry her back to the house of her now departed hostess, that is what they did. Here she found her hostess's husband and was able to spend a few hours there with him in his house. Consider now what someone with inadequate means can make of such an incident. If we approach it as psychoanalysts, we come upon those secret provinces of the soul that tell us the psyche of the person had a particular experience connected with horses at the age of 7. Accordingly, as the woman left the party and saw the horse-drawn cab, this earlier experience was invoked from her subconscious, and she was so disconcerted by this that instead of jumping aside, she carried on running in front of the cab. For the psychoanalyst, therefore, the whole incident results from the connection between a current experience and, quote, unresolved riddles of the soul, close quote, from former upbringing, and so on. But this is to study things with inadequate means. The psychoanalyst is unaware that the subconscious powers at work here are more substantial in nature than he assumes, a good deal cleverer and more subtle than the conscious mind. This subconscious is also often much more courageous. You see, the psychoanalyst does not know that there was a demon sitting in the woman's soul, and that she left the house with the unconscious idea of being alone with a man once his wife had departed. The whole incident was most cleverly arranged by the subconscious. For you see, one does everything far more certainly and surely if one's conscious mind plays no part in it. The woman ran in front of the horses in order to be saved at the right moment. But the psychoanalyst is unaware of this because he does not assume the existence of a world of soul and spirit to which the human soul is related. Yet Jung does have an intimation of this. From the numerous phenomena he encounters, he senses that the human soul is related to numerous other souls. But he has to be a materialist, after all, since otherwise he wouldn't be an intelligent modern man. So what does he do? He says the following. The human soul, and we see this from all the things that happen to the human soul, is in relationship with spiritual realities outside it. Yet these do not exist. So how can we understand this? Well, the soul possesses a body that is descended from other bodies, and these in turn from earlier ones. This is genetic inheritance, and Jung constructs his thesis around the idea that the soul, therefore, inherits and re-experiences relationships people once had, say, to heathen gods. These experiences are still in us, he thinks, resulting from physical inheritance, and they become, quote, isolated soul provinces, close quote, that the human soul can only free itself from if they are first invoked. He has insight, in fact, into the human soul's need to have a relationship with such things, and understands that they will wreck a person's nervous system if not called up into the conscious mind. He, therefore, expresses something that is absolutely right in terms of a modern outlook, that the human soul cannot be devoid of all relationship to a divine reality without being inwardly deadened. This is just as true in his view as the fact that no such divine reality exists. For him, the question of the human soul's relationship to God does not have the slightest connection with the question of God's existence. This is what he writes. And now let us consider what is at work here. Jung states that the human soul must develop a relationship to God, but that it is equally certain it would be idiotic to assume God exists. Therefore, for the sake of its own health, the soul is condemned to deceive itself by positing a God. This is what Jung writes in his book, really. Quote, deceive yourself that there is a God, otherwise you will fall ill, close quote. These things can show us that great riddles are knocking insistently at our door, while the modern age tries to push back against them. If people were courageous enough, similar things would surface everywhere, but they are not. I am not saying these things to lock horns with Professor Jung, but because I believe that he thinks in a more courageous way than anyone else. He says what he must, given the condition of the modern world. Others do not say such things, for they are less courageous. All such things must be considered if we really wish to grasp what it means, as we discover through spiritual science, that humanity's history, and consequently also the political impulses at work in society, have nothing to do with ordinary consciousness, and that these impulses can only be understood and handled if we develop a capacity for imaginative awareness. As regards what I have often recently called an antisocial view of history within political life, and its chief representative, we might say that Wilsonism needs to be replaced by imaginative perception of reality. But Wilsonism is very widespread, and many are Wilsonians without even knowing it. Names themselves are of no importance. Genuinely important are the realities alive in society. I can actually speak in a more forthright way about Wilson, since I gave my verdict on him before the war already, in a lecture cycle in Helsingfors, Helsinki, and did not need to wait to find out, during the war, what spirit sits enthroned in America. Many adulatory voices have heaped praises on Wilson, but these have gone quiet recently. People have discovered a thing or two, such as the fact that this gentleman on the throne of America, when composing his illustrious Republican Charter, merely copied it from one written in 1864 by Don Pedro, the ruler of Brazil, only altering the phrases that spoke of South American interests and inserting, quote, the interests of the United States, close quote, instead. Adulatory voices were clamoring in Europe, too, when Wilson's two books, titled The New Freedom and titled Mere Literature and Other Essays, appeared. This was only a few years back, 5 or 6 years. People have now learned a thing or two about Wilsonism. But there is a very great deal more to be learned about deeply, deeply incisive modern events, things that can only flourish in the soil of spiritual scientific knowledge, must be taken very seriously. People often accuse anthroposophically oriented spiritual science of being theoretical and object that other schools of thought get directly involved in practical life without bothering people about cosmic evolution and such like. Such schools of thought, they say, speak of love, universal human love, of what and how one should love. Well, millennia have passed while people spoke about love in this way, and we can see where it has got us. If instead you allow the human soul to engage for a much shorter time with a science of the spirit, really engage with it though, you will see that this spiritual science blossoms as love in human hearts. You see, you cannot preach love. Love can only grow when it is properly cultivated, and then it grows. And it is an offspring of the spirit. It is also an offspring of true knowledge and perception, one that does not focus on matter alone, but on spirit. Today, in this introductory lecture, I simply wanted to point to some feelings that may accompany us during this period and could be important. And I have outlined what ground I wish to cover in forthcoming lectures. I will be discussing what can awaken strength, courage, and hope in the human soul. I want to speak about all that the science of the spirit can give humanity that is different from what many previous centuries have given it. And I wish to speak of spiritual science as something alive that is not theoretical, but can give birth in us to a second spiritual human being, one that sustains the first and gives it stability in the world. As you know, during the medieval period, many people conceived the urgent desire to create gold. Why did they wish to do this? Really, they desired something that cannot be realized in ordinary earthly conditions, and this was because they recognized that unless spiritualized, permeated by spiritual impulses, these ordinary earthly conditions can never bring true contentment. Ultimately, this is also the message of the Gospels. But people usually overlook the most important things. They criticize the view of the Gospels that the divine realm descended to earth. But is it not here among us? It is, just not in any outwardly apparent signs. It has to be inwardly grasped. It must not be denied as our era denies it. And this descent of the Spirit to earth is also something we will speak about over the forthcoming period. So, today, I only wanted to sound an underlying note. In our time, it is necessary, for there are now millions of souls who have crossed the threshold of death to build the bridge to the realm where the dead live. They live amongst us, and we can find them. And how we can do so is something we will be speaking of too in a renewed way. The end of Lecture 1.